Our final presentation this afternoon is provided by a wonderful educational leader, a wonderful researcher, and also a wonderful leader of professional learning. And the presentation is by Professor David Hopkins, who holds key roles at both the University of Bolton and also the University of Nottingham. David is quite a brilliant man who has had a significant impact on policy as well as on practice when we think about how leaders look at improvement and how they enact strategies to improve our schools and our outcomes. He's very deeply thoughtful, a person who's driven by a very, very strong moral purpose. And also, I think you'll find as you listen to him this afternoon, driven by deep clarity and also courage. The role he's played in challenging the assumptions that we've held and carried forward from the past and caused us to question the impact of those policies and assumptions for the future has been quite profound. David is coming to us today by a pre-recorded video. He is quite unwell. We thank him enormously for his ongoing contribution to ACL, and we also very much wish him well. So thank you to David, and please enjoy his session this afternoon.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I'm David Hopkins, and I'm speaking to you from the glorious Peak District in England. We're pre-recording this session because I have to go into hospital shortly, and I may still be there at the time of this global conference. So we're doing this to make certain that I actually do appear. And I'm very pleased to be with you, even if it is only virtually. It's a strange time in our world. And the title of our conference today, Leading Successful Learning in a Changed World, is absolutely appropriate. The advent of the pandemic, of the COVID-19 pandemic, has changed instantaneously all of our lives. And I must probably am not alone wondering about when this is going to end and whether we will ever return to normal. Over Christmas, my partner Trish Franey gave me a copy of Robert Harris's new book called The Second Sleep. And in that book, Harris elegantly describes a dystopian society. And as I was reading it, I began to sort of be amazed by how different the society that Harris described was it was from what went before. And then a few weeks later, we had the spread of COVID, and our lives have changed as well. And that is the case even more so, I think, for education, that in the lives, the school lives of the children in your country and in my country have changed very dramatically. And those of us who are committed to equity are really worried about the outcomes on generations of students. There are three, for me, fundamental questions about the impact of school closure on the learning of students. And these, on the slide there, these questions have been answered by the Education Endowment Foundation, which is one of our leading organisations and charities for educational research in the UK. What impact do school closures have on learning? Sadly, the evidence suggests that they learn less when they're not in school. What is the impact on disadvantaged students? There's a broad consensus that school closures have a stronger negative effect on disadvantaged children than their peers. And thirdly, what is the impact of school closures on the attainment gap? And sadly, there's a strong likelihood that the school closures due to COVID-19 will increase the attainment gap between disadvantaged children and their peers. This paper was written just at the start of the pandemic in England. And unfortunately, subsequent research has only endorsed these findings. So against these sort of rather negative responses, what can we as educators and leaders do? And here I stand full square with the McKinsey organization. When they were reflecting upon the impact of the pandemic, they argued that issues regarding equity, which is ensuring that the needs of the most vulnerable are met, should be front and center, both during the closure and after students return to school. And I couldn't agree more. Those of us who are driven by a moral purpose must worry enormously about the impact on the attainment gap and on equity overall that the pandemic is having on us. The question is then, how do we respond? And McKinsey have recently set out 5 steps: resolve, resilience, return, reimagine, and reform. And they say that these are the steps we should move through and beyond the pandemic. And I want to focus the rest of this presentation on the last of these steps. How can we reimagine what the next normal could be like? Because certainly we're not going back to the way things were. And how education systems can reinvent themselves. And then I think the fifth step is reform, and how we reconsider education priorities in the light of these of the lessons learned. And as I reflect on this, I'm taken very much back to one of the eternal truths that I hold in terms of what we know about successful school systems. All the evidence from PISA and other global studies about success suggests that the quality of a school or school system cannot exceed the quality of its people. The only way to improve student outcomes is to improve the quality of teaching, and high performance requires that every child succeeds. That, for me, is the essence of equity. And those of you who are familiar with my work, particularly in Australia, and the Curiosity and Powerful Learning School Improvement Program that I'm associated with, will find these conclusions unsurprising. And what I want to say in terms of our response builds very largely on the work that we have been doing on Curiosity and Powerful Learning, particularly most recently in New South Wales. I have just published a paper in the Australian Educational Leader called Unleashing Greatness. And in the paper, I describe 8 steps that, in my opinion, and on the basis of my experience with working with schools like yours, will actually lead to enhanced student outcomes, the narrowing of the achievement gap, the increase in equity, and the increase in social mobility. And I call the paper Unleashing Greatness for a very good reason. My friend and colleague Michael Barber once memorably pointed out that one can mandate the move from awful to adequate and fair to good, but as one progresses, one needs to unleash greatness. And that, I think, is where many Australian schools are, and certainly the schools that I'm privileged to work with in New South Wales are. That we can't achieve equity, we can't achieve the highest of standards just by mandating it by top-down change. We have to create the conditions where schools can by themselves fulfill their moral purpose, either alone or preferably in networks. And the 8 steps that you can see on the slide are the ones that I want to briefly describe and talk to in the rest of this presentation. And those of you who can access, who have copies of the Australian Educational Leader, can actually read the full article. We have to begin by clarifying our moral purpose. But our moral purpose needs to focus on classroom practice. We then decide what is non-negotiable. We develop a narrative around that. We create a language for learning. We work together as colleagues in peer coaching and triad relationships. We take a form of leadership which is based upon pedagogy, on teaching and learning. And we network to share the best of our practice and to learn from each other. Let me take you fairly briefly through these 8 stages. A lot of us talk about moral purpose, and it was Mike Fullan who sort of first introduced the phrase into education. But moral purpose is not just about values, it's also about action. The key message is that moral purpose and strategic action are the opposite sides of the same coin. Neither is sufficient by itself. We realise, as I say there, our moral purpose through strategic action, and strategic action is a means of delivering on our moral purpose. But we also have to be very articulate about what we mean by moral purpose. This slide is one that I'm very, very fond of. As some of you know, I was responsible for school standards in England in the early part of this century, in the first 5 years of the 2000s. And some of you will know some of the history of education in England at that time, where we were moving from a very successful period of top-down change to one which I tried to base around the principles of personalization and the moral purpose that I have just been articulating. And I began to sort of illustrate this change in policy through this slide and the quotes from the mouths of these young people here. So when we talk about moral purpose, we also, I think, need to go a little bit deeper. And if we're serious about social mobility and equity, I think we need to go and try to explore the notion of a life script. I think this is really germane to these discussions. A life script is a sort of narrative that individuals have for themselves. And all of us who are listening to this broadcast today have very successful life scripts. We've all sort of done well in school, at university, and have good and demanding and fulfilling jobs. Sadly, not all the young people who come into our schools have positive life scripts. And so part of our moral purpose, it seems to me, is to actually try to take a serious look at the sort of the narratives that our young people have and to try to help them to become increasingly positive by the work environment, by the positive culture that we create inside our schools. So that's, you know, that's sort of what I sort of mean by moral purpose. And it's that drives us to do our very best for our young people. But we resolve the moral purpose, as I have already intimated, by focusing on classroom practice. Because it's the quality of what goes on in our classrooms and taking together our schools, which will surely have the impact upon our young people. The picture there is of a mentor of mine, Bruce Joyce. Some of you will be familiar with his work on peer coaching and his work on models of teaching. And a few years ago, Bruce and I wrote that learning experiences are composed of content, process, and social climate. As teachers, we create for and with our children opportunities to build and explore important areas of knowledge, develop powerful tools for learning, and to live in humanizing social conditions. I think that's a really good definition of what exciting classrooms do. They actually do create knowledge. They do give us youngsters learning skills, and they do sort of help our youngsters achieve the social skills that will enable them to become good citizens. The framework that I use in our work in Curiosity and Powerful Learning is on the screen now, where I sort of say that classroom practice is composed of curriculum, of pedagogy, teaching and learning, of student learning skills, and assessment for learning. Those are the sort of the main constructs that create effective classroom practice. And we've got to realize that a change in one means a change in the other. And I think this is where networking really has power, because we can share our curriculum, our teaching strategies, our learning skills, and approaches to assessment with each other and become more powerful as a consequence of that. But the key point here is that these four elements interact and create the tasks that our young people do. And it's our tasks that actually predict their performance. I also tend in my own work in Curiosity and Powerful Learning to focus more on teaching than I do on curriculum. For two reasons. One is that, as John Hattie has shown us over the last 10 years, teaching can have very, very powerful effects on student outcomes. And also, teaching is quicker to change than the curriculum, which is often sort of the result of governmental change, which always takes time, rather than changes in the way in which the school creates powerful learning conditions for its young people. And I'm very struck by this table from John's work that he sort of presented in his monograph that was based upon his lecture to the ACL conference a couple of years ago. Because if you look in the sort of the right-hand column, the high impact investments in building academic achievement are all activities which are in control of the teacher and the school. And they are virtually all of those are related to teacher behaviors in the classroom, over which we have total control. So that's a word or two about our sort of the focus on classroom practice. And that's the rationale for really focusing on that. So we have moral purpose. We manifest our moral purpose in the teaching that we create for our students. And then I think in terms of creating powerful conditions inside the school, we then need to decide on what are the non-negotiables. My friend and colleague Michael Fullan, again, said some years ago that that with all the changes that schools are presented with, try and do one or two things as well as you possibly can and everything else as well as you would do otherwise. And that's why when we're creating a development agenda for ourselves, we need to decide on the non-negotiables, be very clear about that, and then we install capable and like-minded people in critical positions, secure resources for that, and get early wins on the board. And that sort of the notion of the non-negotiables relates, I think, to one of the distinctions I make between maintenance and development in schools. Maintenance activities are just the permanent structures, the staffing, the roles and the hierarchies that we have. And that's what schools continue to do on a day-to-day basis. But if we're going to improve our schools, then we need also to have a development structure, which is where how we actually introduce change into the school and uses this change to sort of impact and over time permeate and adjust our overall maintenance structures as well. And the key driver in the development system is a school improvement team. And one of the non-negotiables I have for my schools is that they identify a school improvement team who become the internal change agents of the school. And the school improvement team become the folk who we train in the new teaching strategies, the new leadership and staff development strategies, and they introduce them to the school overall. So they become the sort of the real powerhouse for change inside the school. And I don't think you can really have an effective school improvement strategy without a school improvement team. Once we've got those things in place, once we've clarified our moral purpose, once we've decided on the classroom focus, developed and identified the non-negotiables, then what we need to be doing is to develop a narrative around these, which becomes the dominant way of working and the dominant language for the school and its community. And I emphasize narratives because stories really matter. They're psychologically privileged. They lodge somewhere in the brain, in a powerful part of the brain. They provide the currency of our thoughts. They are the language we talk in. And they are flight simulators for the mind. They help us visualize what our future is going to be. And the narrative is really important because once we have a narrative, then the right idea helps people, makes people believe, an emotional idea makes people care, and the right story makes people act. So the narrative becomes the driver for the changes that we want to introduce into the school. And I know of no successful school that doesn't have a very powerful narrative that sort of drives it onwards. And on this slide, and you'll all have access to the slide, these are some sort of examples of or characteristics of what an effective story actually looks like. So now we move from there into what I'm calling here on the slide, instructional rounds and theories of action. A number of you will have been involved with me in doing instructional rounds, where we actually go into each other's school, we observe, and then generate some hypotheses about teaching and learning as a consequence of those observations. What is different about this approach to observation is that our observations are non-judgmental. I'm very insistent that we don't make judgments. These are not about evaluation. They're about describing what we are seeing. And as a consequence of the rounds, we actually are able in the position to develop, as a consequence of that, some hypotheses about teaching and learning that is going on inside the school. We take a positive view of this. We are sort of we're very committed to affirmative action in terms of our view of teaching. And we express our hypotheses about our observations in the form of a theory of action, which goes something like this. When a teacher does X, then the students do Y. When a teacher consistently asks higher order questions, then the students are more actively engaged and they begin to develop their own curriculum knowledge. I must now have done hundreds of instructional rounds in Australian schools, in English schools, in Welsh schools in China and Chile. What has been interesting is that despite the variety of contexts, despite the sort of the phase of education, I still come out with the same types of theories of action. And that I find very sort of exciting. It suggests to me that good pedagogy, good teaching, is a global language and can be as powerful in rural schools as it can be in urban schools and in countries as diverse as Chile and China and England and Wales and Australia. And those again of you who are familiar with my work will know that I've written manuals on this, the Curiosity and Powerful Learning Manual, which is obtainable from ACL, identifies six theories of action for the teacher, which are the consistent ones which come out of the instructional rounds that we gather. And John Hattie's been helpful in providing us with his barometer of effects to demonstrate the power that they have. Our theories of action are to do with learning intentions, setting challenging tasks, framing higher order questions, connecting feedback to data, committing to assessment for learning, and implementing cooperative groups. And we go even further than this, because what we do is to develop rubrics or protocols related to each of these theories of action that you and can use with colleagues for peer observation and peer coaching inside the classroom. And we produce each of these protocols at four levels of teacher behavior: at beginning practice, at intermediate practice, at accomplished practice, and at expert practice. So again, using the protocols, we can scaffold the development of our colleagues. And this leads me then on to peer coaching. And we utilize a coaching model in our work with colleagues in schools. Because if we're going to acquire a new skill, which a teaching behavior is, all of the evidence suggests that we need to actually have the theory, we need to understand what it's all about. We need to see it, we need to have a demonstration of it, we need to practice it in non-threatening situations and receive feedback again in non-threatening situations from our colleagues. And we design our workshops around these principles. And once we've achieved a degree of competence, then we are able to actually peer coach each other inside classrooms. So our staff development strategy is very much based upon the workshop setting where there is expert coaching, and then a workplace setting where we actually peer coach each other in triads inside our own classrooms. And I recommend very strongly that the whole staff belongs to a triad. We divide the whole staff into groups of three, and it's these three, and it's these groups of three colleagues following the workshop, meet regularly, observe each other in pairs using the protocol, soon after discuss data, then share with the other colleague, and then repeat that cycle over a period of time. I also suggest that they have a meeting at the end of every half term to discuss progress. But this need not be very time consuming. The observations may only need to take 10 minutes, and the debrief can take over, can occur during lunchtime or in coffee breaks. So it becomes, and once we actually begin to establish this routine and way of working in the school, it becomes a very, very powerful form of professional learning. And all the schools in Curiosity and Powerful Learning who have been through this attest to the power and the change in work culture that happens once once triads become embedded. This now leads me on to the seventh of my steps for unleashing greatness, and that is a commitment to leadership, which is in the form of instructional leadership. I wrote a paper with my colleagues Ken Leithwood and Alma Harris 10 years ago called Seven Strong Claims about leadership. And I'm happy to say and pleased to say that that was the most quoted paper on leadership that has been, particularly in the last decade. So we revisited our original research, and as Jeff and Jess sort of produced another version of the paper. And it's interesting that our seven strong claims seem to be well supported by the most recent of research. The school leadership is second only to classroom practice as an influence on student learning. Almost all successful school leaders draw on the same basic repertoire of leadership practice. It's the context that makes the difference, and it's how we adapt strategies, how we adapt John Hattie's visible learning meta-analyses to the context in which we're working that makes a difference. The ideas remain the same. It's the adaptation that is crucial to context. And you can read the rest of those for yourselves. For us, what has been exciting has been the identification of these sort of four domains of practice that instructional leaders employ. They set direction. That's the moral purpose. They build relationships and develop people. That's the professional development based around peer coaching and triads I've just described. They develop the organization to support desired practices. That's a development structure that involves the school improvement team, and they improve the instructional program. They focus unrelentingly on teaching and learning. So then we move to our last strategy or last component of unleashing greatness, which is based on network action. And again, the evidence is really, really strong that schools make more progress when they're collaborating with other schools with a genuine and substantive focus on teaching practice. And you can see on the slide there some of the elements or components of that, and I will let you sort of read those for yourselves. But networking, which is driven by a collective moral purpose, really has incredible power and can really have a massive impact on local communities. And by that token, have a great purchase on equity and social mobility. This slide here, which is the last one in this sequence, is really a summary of how I think effective networks work. They have a regional director or director of educational leadership who then sort of generates a cadre or selects a cadre of local trainers. These local trainers work with a school improvement group, and the school improvement then inside the individual schools interfaces with the triads, which themselves, as I said, are the powerhouses for instructional change. Well, I have described those eight steps in a linear fashion because I guess it's easier to do it that way. But the important point is that you don't have to follow each of those steps sequentially. You have to actually incorporate all of those steps, I believe, inside your school improvement strategy. But you don't necessarily start with number one and go to number two or go to number three. In some of the schools I've been working with recently in England, there's been a strong focus on the curriculum because our inspection agency, Ofsted, is looking particularly recently at curriculum. And they've wanted to start with the curriculum. So that's fine. We start with the curriculum. We then go and develop effective schemes of work. And then we look from the curriculum to the classroom practice that I have just been describing. We engage in instructional rounds with our colleague schools. We then sort of probably will develop the triads and peer coaching. But then we move back and actually then develop the narrative out of these actions and link that to our moral purpose and our non-negotiables. And our instructional leadership consolidates this way of working and also interacts with leaders, with instructional leaders from other schools in the network to actually provide more power for the realization of our moral purpose across our network system. So that, ladies and gentlemen, is what I wanted to share with you. That's the paper called Unleashing Greatness. And it's based on the work, largely on the work I've been doing with schools who are linked to ACL and on the Curiosity and Powerful Learning program. But I can write a paper on school improvement, but I know a little bit about how the process works. But you've got to realize that you are the world expert in your school. And it's how you take those ideas and apply them to your own setting that will make all the difference and will realize the moral purpose that you have for your colleagues, for your students, and for your community. And remember what Gandhi said, that you must be the change to see in the world, and to live as if you were to die tomorrow, and to learn as if you were to live forever. I wish you well for the rest of your conference. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to talk with you, and I hope to see some of you in person before too long. Take care and bless you all.